that you're born an Italian. If you want your life to be great, see that you're born an Italiano and your life will be great. From the moment you're a small bambino, you eat pizza, you drink vino.
Then they make you roly-poly.
You get stuffed with ravioli. If your mama's a paisano, you will have the world on a plate. So see that you're born an Italiano and your life will be great.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Italian American Podcast. And buon anno, happy new year. 2021 is here, and it's great to be back after a week off the air with the Italian American Podcast. I'm your host, John Viola, joined today by my partner in crime, the notorious POB, Pat O'Boyle. And we have a very special guest with us today to discuss a topic that has just started to sort of percolate in the Italian news and the Italian American news, and one that we really got excited about when the opportunity came up. So I'm going to welcome back a man that we are officially deputizing as the official historian of the Italian American Podcast. The last episode that he joined us was one of our highest rated of 2020, and he's a good friend and the author of so many great works on the history of Southern Italy and genealogy of Southern Italy and all of our traditions. But most recently, the new book, The Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, 1734 to 1861, which we spoke about a little bit last time, and I think many in our audience, I know from our conversations online and our Facebook group of the New Neighborhood, have already read. And if you haven't, it's one of my absolute high recommendations from 2020. You've heard his voice before, and it's really good to have Lou Mendola back on the Italian American Podcast. So Lou, coming to us from Palermo, welcome back.
Hi, it's good to be here. Hope you guys are well this year.
Yeah, thank God. So far, so good. We're a couple of days in.
Do they have no idea we've just been talking for the last 2 hours?
Well, that's...
we had a two-hour comment. We're like, oh, we're all done. Oh, we got into a podcast. So.
Yeah, that's normal when it's catching up with good friends and yeah. So much going on.
If you go to Sicily, you got to take Lou out to dinner.
Yeah, that's true.
Because you're going to get more out of dinner with Lou than 8,000 books, 5,000 movies, 6,000 tours. Just tell Lou, let's go to dinner. And that's going to be worth the whole trip. If you have nothing to do and you want to do something, go to Palermo, go see Lou, and it's worth the whole trip.
We've had some of those long catch-up dinners, and the last one, I think, was over Chinese food in Chinatown here in New York.
Yeah.
But, you know, Lou, you are such a font of knowledge. Before we talk about what we're here to talk about today, tell us a little bit how the book is going. How's the reaction to the book been?
Pretty good. You know, strictly speaking, it's the second book I've written that kind of deals with this subject. The first one was in 2015, and it was about the Kingdom of Sicily, not specifically the two Sicilies, from the 1100s up until 1861. But this book is basically, the focus is basically from about 1700 to about 1860, 1861. And the reception has been pretty good. You know, it's in a few libraries, and it's a pretty good resource. There's not very much written in English on the subject, okay? This is actually the first book of any length that's been written on the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies in English. So that's pretty good. I'm pretty satisfied with that.
I mean, I know the people that we've talked to that have read it in our audience, you know, we exchange on the New Neighborhood our recommendations, and we got a great reaction to everybody from the last episode we did, which is available in our archives on the Norman history of the Kingdom of Sicily. And many people were kind of waiting for it when it came out. So there was a lot of excitement about it, and people have been gobbling it up and really enjoying it. It's a phenomenal resource, and it's appropriate to the topic that we have for the show today, because a few weeks ago in December, the announcement was made from the Archdiocese of Naples, and the outgoing Cardinal Archbishop of Naples, Cardinal Seppe, announced that two candidates were being placed for the advancement of the cause of beatification from the Archdiocese, one of whom was Francesco II, Francis II, the last king of the Two Sicilies. And obviously, the book covers all of the Bourbon kings of Two Sicilies and ends with Francis II, popularly known as Franceschiella, an amazing character. And I don't want to give away too much of the history because Lou's much better at it than me. But so now we have all of this excitement generated around the idea that the final king of the Two Sicilies has been proposed for advancement for beatification, which I know, Pat, you can give us more detail on as we get deeper into the show. But it's really exciting. It's a lot of, generated a lot of buzz around Naples and in the circles that love this kind of stuff. It's a great opportunity to come and share the history of a figure that is obviously not just important to Southern Italian history, but hugely important to the history of the diaspora, because it's after his exile from Naples that such a huge population of the South begins to leave after being the country with the lowest emigration rate in Europe up until that point. And so I thought it would be just a great opportunity to discuss this fascinating life. And really, the more you dig into it, one that you see is really a beautiful man of faith, a man of honor and virtue, and one that ties into the history of so much of our listenership. So, Lou, can you give us a little sort of overview of the life and brief reign of Francis II?
Francis II was born in the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, which in the 19th century was actually the most prosperous and wealthiest, most industrially advanced of the Italian states before unification, and the most populous too. It had, you know, much larger population than Piedmont and the Papal States and these other places. He was born into the House of Bourbon in 1836. He was a son of King Ferdinand II and Maria Cristina of Savoy, who was the daughter of Victor Emmanuel I of Sardinia. I should mention at the outset that he never really knew his mother. She died in childbirth. She was known as a very devout, saintly woman, and in fact, she was beatified in 2014. Anyway, Francis was raised to be king. He was the eldest son. He spoke Neapolitan as his first language before he spoke Italian or French or German, never spoke any English as far as we know. And he was eventually married to Maria Sophia of Wittelsbach, who was a princess of the ducal house of Bavaria. She was born in 1841, so a few years younger than him. They got married in January of 1859. And unfortunately, a few months later, in May, Ferdinand II died. This left Francis as king of the Two Sicilies, as the eldest son. He had siblings, half brothers and half sisters, through his father's second wife. So anyway, he was a very young man, and the gist of it is that he had the traditional preparation for being a king. He had a military education. He was well educated for those times, in a fairly sophisticated place, a rather industrialized society for those times. He knew the country well. He knew Europe quite well. By all accounts, he was an intelligent person. But unfortunately, he was very young. And his wife was even younger. So you have this couple, very young, and all of a sudden, they're forced into a situation where they have to run a country, which was technically an absolute monarchy. There was no constitution at that time. And it was a very, let's say, tumultuous time in Italy. There were revolutions. There were debates over whether a constitution should be instituted to make it into a constitutional monarchy. So what happened was, in the Italian unification movement, which had been going on for a few decades, there had been several efforts to bring the country together, what is now Italy. And I'm not digressing with this. I just wanted to kind of explain the background. Francis's father was one of the people who initially supported Italian unification a couple decades earlier. Even the Pope actually supported it. The Vatican, or I should say the papacy at that time, did support it. But their condition was that the Pope would have to be the ruler of all of Italy. And obviously nobody else would accept that. So Ferdinand II had been a very strong king. He was actually a little bit overzealous at times because not only would he be willing to defend his own country, but for example, in 1848, when there were some revolts, he suppressed them rather zealously, rather forcefully, although he very rarely executed people. He would commute sentences and so forth. 1848 was a crazy year. There were revolutions that spread across Europe, not only in southern Italy, but in Piedmont, eventually in France and other countries. So obviously, Francis II had grown up with this. The other thing that he grew up with was a very strong religious devotion. That might be good when you're a bishop. It might not necessarily be that fantastic when you're a king, because the job of being a king could bring about other circumstances. You might have to lead your people in a war, okay, hopefully a defensive war. Hopefully you're not attacking anybody. So this was the situation of Francis II.
Can I ask a quick question, Lou?
Yes.
Is it true that he wanted to be a monk, but that there was no way for him, that his father would not allow him to kind of abdicate his position?
That story probably is not literally true. However, he was so devout that it became well known, especially after 1861, when he was deposed, that he had this devotion. And in the late 50s, when Giuseppe Tomasi di Lampedusa wrote Il Gatto Pardo, The Leopard, which is kind of like a Sicilian Gone with the Wind, because the book is set in the 1860s, which made the bestseller lists, not only in Italy, but even in the United States, and they did a movie. In the book, the author refers to him as a seminarian dressed up as a general. So that was generally the opinion that people had of him. Maybe not a very wide opinion at the time in the 1850s, because royal courts at that time were not as open. Obviously, there was no social media back then. Okay, so it was not like somebody had a Twitter account and you knew everything that the king was doing. Okay, but let's just say that that was generally known in court circles, that he was very devout. And they had said that about his mother. His mother was extremely devout.
And she's a blessed now, for those of you who don't know, Blessed Maria Christina of Savoy.
Right, in December of 2014. She was beatified. So they would refer to him as the son of the saint. And it's quite possible that much of his devotion may have been rooted in a knowledge of his mother and her devotion. Of course, you've got to keep in mind also that in those days, in Italy generally, the church played a very large role. And part of the problem with Francis II is that he was a little bit under the tutelage of Pope Pius IX. The problem is that Pope Pius IX is the kind of pope that historians and theologians either love or they hate. Okay, you could write an entire encyclopedia about the pontificate of Pius IX.
Agree 100%. Yeah, 100%.
Okay, now long story short, theologically he was conservative. Okay, but the things that he did theologically were not really things that necessarily touched the life of the average person very closely. Okay, for example, he eventually came up with the doctrine of papal infallibility. He formalized the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception. Okay, this is what he's remembered for in theological circles. Those doctrines are significant in the church, but you could be a Catholic your entire life and a practicing Catholic, and the issue of papal infallibility or the Immaculate Conception really does not have an impact on your personal life, okay?
And for the non-Catholic listeners, or for the Catholic listeners who are not really like schooled on this, those two concepts alone would be a whole separate podcast.
Yeah,
right.
But
it's
not like when we talk about papal infallibility, the papal infallibility doesn't cover you if the Pope says 2 + 2 = 5. Catholic doctrine doesn't say the Pope is infallible. The way that Pius IX, the way that it came out of the First Vatican Council, it basically said was that there was a primacy of Rome in the history of the church.
Right.
And kind of when questions came out, the Pope had the job of articulating what had always been agreed and believed. I guess, is that a good way of putting it?
Yeah.
Yes, and also the other thing is that, let's consider this, that the Roman Church got along perfectly well for many centuries without a formal declaration of papal infallibility or the Immaculate Conception, okay? So anyway, Pius IX was known for this, but what's more significant, perhaps in a practical way, to the unification of Italy is that he was pretty much opposed to the unification of Italy unless it were under him. Okay.
Which is a very Italian concept.
Yes, exactly.
So, I mean, we're trying to say, well, he was the Pope.
Right.
But let's be honest. It's a very Italian. Yeah, you can unify as long as I'm still the boss. So, like, you know, to be fair.
Right. The real problem for Francis II with Pius IX is that he was obviously, you know, very dogmatic in his politics, and he had maybe an undue influence over the king. The other thing was that nobody really ever thought of, let's say, invading the kingdom of the two Sicilies under Ferdinand II. Okay, he commanded the largest standing army in Italy, and he was willing to use it. And he didn't have a problem if his opponents might happen to be Austrian or French or whatever the alliance was. Okay, the Savoys didn't even enter into it because Sardinia, Piedmont, which was the other, let's say, kingdom in Italy, didn't have the resources to take on that army if it were led by a competent person. So essentially, Ferdinand II was tough.
For the sake of the listeners that are not really aware of the politics, I mean, anybody who's been listening to the show long term, you know, has heard before the kind of pre-unitary situation. But I do want to make clear, prior to the unification, like Lou says, you have this gigantic state in the south that is everything kind of south of Rome today, and Sicily included. And then you have the papal states in the middle, which are not just the lands of the church theologically, but also actually ruled directly by a papal monarchy. The Pope is also the temporal monarch of the territory as well. That's basically the swath of central Italy. You have the Grand Dukes of Tuscany and the smaller states and dukedoms, and I guess they're all dukes, right? Up in the center there.
Yeah, right. You had Tuscany and Modena and Parma and, you know.
Whatever. Right, all of these sort of micro monarchies. And then in the northwest, you have the state of Savoy, the kingdom of Sardinia and Savoy, which was the island of Sardinia and the historic territories of the dukes and then kings of Savoy. And then you have the area in Lombardia, Milano, and those areas attached after Napoleon's invasions to Venice. And so you have this state of Lombardy Venezia, which is directly ruled by a branch of the Habsburgs of Austria. So it's really Austrian territory. So the idea in 1848, as all of these revolutions explode out across Europe, and of course, the first one being in Sicily, they spread all over Europe. It really shakes up the entire map and this idea of constitutional representation. And this movement towards nationalism starts throughout Europe. It's going to eventually create Italy in the 1860-61, and then Germany out of the cluster of different microstates that were eventually the German Empire. And the idea at its earliest stage is that all of these Italian territories can unite into some kind of federation with the Pope at its head. But there were also many advocates that wanted to unite under, at that point, the strongest monarch and the richest state, which is Ferdinand II, the father of Francesco. And the family was clearly deeply tied to not only the church, but also this Pope himself, Pius IX. They gave him refuge when he had to escape Rome during those revolutions. They interacted in a very familial way with Pius IX, and it was offered up to Ferdinand eventually to unite Italy in this federation under himself as a king, and he simply wouldn't do it because he wouldn't move against the papacy. And that theme of the papacy sort of awing the Bourbon monarchs is going to come back at the end for Francis II as well, right? I mean,
yes, yes. I would also say that, for example, during the revolutions of 1848, when the Pope had insurrections in Rome, he went down to Gaeta, which we'll talk about later also as a place. Gaeta was on the coast north of Naples. He went there and he obtained refuge from Ferdinand II, to give you an idea of how close they were connected. The other thing is that when you had a king who would not break away from that, obviously the people who wanted to unite what became Italy found it an obstacle. And the interesting thing about him and also Pius IX is that they started out as very progressive people. As time went by, and especially things like the revolution of 1848, they became more conservative. They became more reactionary. Another point I'd like to make in this is that there's been a lot of propaganda. When you read books about the unification, books that were written, let's say, before the last 15 or 20 years, there's a lot of perspectives that will describe the two Sicilies as this ultra, ultra repressive state. But the fact is that in Piedmont, you couldn't exactly, let's say, write an article, a newspaper article against the king either. There wasn't really freedom of the press up there. There was really no complete freedom of the press anywhere in what is now Italy. Okay. In fact, much of Europe did not have what we would call freedom of expression, freedom, you know, public freedom of expression. The other thing is that around 1848, you had a lot of Piedmontese who left Piedmont, and where'd they go? California. A few of them ended up going during the gold rush, 1849, 1850. But you had this first wave of true emigration from Italy came from northern Italy. And some of it was political.
Well, Garibaldi himself was a political refugee.
Yes, he was exiled. He was exiled for a little while. And even people like Antonio Meucci, who he knew in New York, had left for those types of reasons. So this was a situation in Italy. I just want to say that the historiography has been very slanted. So we get to the year 1859, 1860. There's an invasion of Sicily by Giuseppe Garibaldi's troops, the so-called thousands. Initially, this was painted as just a bunch of people who wanted to unify the country, and they weren't really representing any state, okay, in the sense of a flag. The fact is that their ships were shadowed along the Italian coast to Sicily, to Marsala, by Piedmontese escorts, who then broke away. And when they got to Marsala, there were British ships, one British warship in particular, that let them disembark at the port of Marsala. In fact, there were Bourbon troops there, national troops, that did not want to attack the British. So you've got the British maneuvering a ship in front of the line of fire. So they let Garibaldi's people disembark. This could have been stopped. Unfortunately, it wasn't. Part of the problem was that Francis II was not a very charismatic leader. And there were probably people already, generals and colonels, who were losing faith in him. The other thing is, it appears that a few high officers had been bribed. Another point in this is that despite what people like to say, that this was all kind of an improvised last minute thing, the reality is that it's as early as 1859 at Plombières in France, there was a conference where Cavour had sounded out the French about the idea of an invasion of southern Italy, and he wanted to know if the French would back him up. And there were other things that were discussed involving things regarding, let's say, the Austrians in northern Italy and this kind of thing. So the whole point is that the invasion of 1860 was kind of an international thing that was planned. And what happened is the king of Sardinia at the time, Victor Emmanuel II, and Cavour and his other people wanted to have what we might call today plausible deniability. They wanted to be able to say, in case it failed, or whatever might have happened in Sicily, oh, well, we had nothing to do with it. We did not authorize it. Garibaldi was acting on his own. Garibaldi did not at that time have a military commission with the Royal Sardinian Army or Navy. So technically speaking, even though he had been one of their officers in the past, he went into Sicily in 1860, essentially politically, technically on his own. But as I say, the reality was it was anything but an independent invasion. It was basically an undeclared war.
It kind of reeks of the situation we've watched unfold over the past few years in the Crimea.
Yes.
You know, Russian troops with their insignia blotted out, but the whole world knows they're Russian troops, you know, but they're branded freedom fighters. But in reality, we know where the money's coming from. And we
Yes, because very often when you have mercenaries, they might not technically have a flag, but they're being bankrolled by somebody. The point is, in the case of Garibaldi's people, they were all Italian, mostly from northern Italy. There weren't that many southerners in there. So unfortunately, they made it inland. They made it to Palermo. There were lengthy negotiations between the general who was defending Palermo and Garibaldi's troops, because there was a very, very real chance that they would have been stopped at Palermo. In fact, the Battle of Palermo went on for days. It was almost guerrilla warfare, street to street. There are photographs of barricades, buildings being blown up. It was quite destructive for those days. You had what was essentially a civil war. So Palermo falls, you know, after a week. And there again, you have to wonder what the general was thinking who was supposed to defend the city. So before long, you have Garibaldi's people going up the peninsula. They get to Calabria and they're making their way up north. And Francesco has to defend the country at this point. So with the enemy making its way towards Naples, which could have defended itself, okay? Instead, he decided that he didn't want to see the civilian slaughter in Naples like what had happened in Palermo and the destruction and so forth. So he decided, he was perhaps ill-advised, to go up to Gaeta, up the coast, and make his last stand there. And that's what happened. They went up there, and that's how Naples fell. There was really no extended battle of Naples. Basically, Garibaldi just walked in.
You know, we have a moment in history now with a 23-year-old monarch who's been reigning for a few months and his 19-year-old wife, and they have to make the decision to leave Naples. And I was going to do this at the end of the episode, but I want to read this letter that he writes to the people of Naples before he leaves, because it's going to set the stage for really what is the seminal point in his kingship, and it's going to inform the rest of his life, which is Gaeta and the loss of the kingdom. So before we get to his escape, I just want to set the scene that we have a 23-year-old pious monarch, unfortunately ill-prepared for the job, his 19-year-old queen, who is a vivacious and energetic young woman from Germany. And Garibaldi lands in May of 1860, and by September of 1860, September 5th, Francis writes this proclamation. It's issued to subjects throughout the kingdom, but particularly Naples. People of Naples, of all the duties demanded of a monarch, those performed in times of adversity are the most difficult and solemn, and I intend to carry them out in a manner and spirit befitting a descendant of so long a line of kings. Regrettably, I must now leave Naples. An unjust war, one which was not wanted by my people, has overrun my kingdom. despite the fact that I was at peace with all of the European powers. My paramount concern now is to protect this illustrious city, to protect its people from ruin and war, to safeguard its inhabitants and their possessions, the holy temples, the monuments, the public buildings, the art galleries, and everything else that constitutes the patrimony of its civilization and greatness, which, belonging to future generations, must not be sacrificed to transitory passions of the moment. War is approaching the walls of the city, and it is with ineffable sadness that I leave. I commend the devotion of the ministry, and I call upon the honor and civic sense of the mayor of Naples and the commander of the police to spare our beloved city the horrors of internal disturbances. As a descendant of a dynasty that has ruled over this kingdom for 126 years, after having saved it from the prolonged miseries of the viceregal government, my affections remain here. I am a Neapolitan and cannot bid farewell to my beloved people, my compatriots, without bitter grief. Whatever my destiny may be, I will always cherish for them a lasting and affectionate memory. I recommend to them peace and concord and observance of their duties as citizens. Let not an immoderate attachment for my crown become a source of turbulence. If the course of the present war should lead me back among you, or if on some future day it may please God to restore me to the throne of my ancestors, rendered more splendid by the free institutions with which I have endowed it, what I most fervently pray for is to find my people united, strong, and happy. And it reading that kind of gives you chills, because you can see in this letter really why the episode today is as much about the potential for sainthood as it is for the story of the last king of the South, because you can see where he was driven with concern for his people.
Well, let me just give a little bit of Monsignor O'Boyle Catholic background. Beatification is a step before canonization. And someone who's beatified has a title of blessed. And it's the church's recognition that the heroic sanctity or the martyrdom of a Catholic, that they are in heaven, and that the proof that they are in heaven is that a miracle. After John Paul II in the 1980s, it was one miracle. Before him, from the 1630s, I think, on Urban VIII, it was two miracles.
Right.
And that these two miracles prove that this person's in heaven. And they're basically, God has allowed this so that they can be an inspiration to other Catholics. So beatification was like a local recognition in a local church, meaning like a diocese in the area, a religious order. So the beatification meant that this person is an inspiration to a local part of the Catholic Church. And canonization is there an inspiration to the entire church, the church universal. Before the 1630s, beatifications were handled in the diocese. After 1630s, they were handled by the Vatican. They were very rare, just like canonizations. John Paul II came up and he said we should be canonizing and beatifying a lot more people, because there's been so many holy people that we got to give the modern world more examples of holiness. And he beatified, John Paul II, I think, beatified so many people. It was more than the popes of the past 400 years. So now there's so many people being beatified. They are now being handled. So the process is handled in Rome. The ceremony is handled on a local level. And then once a person is beatified, they can have churches named after them. Their relics are publicly exposed. The church recognizes them as an advocate for the faithful in heaven. And then if another miracle comes about and the Vatican brings them to the next step, then they're canonized, they're made a saint, and that's a universal devotion. Now, a big push behind Francis II is that his mother, Maria Christina of Savoy, and she was a member of the Savoy family, oddly enough. The family who takes him out of power was his mother's family. Tell me that's not an Italian story.
His own first cousin takes him out.
Welcome to
Italy. That's right, his cousin.
Yeah. I had to be, you know. She was known for her sanctity. And Luke, correct me because you're the expert, but what I've gathered is that Francesco's father, being kind of the burly, kind of rough character that he was, the folklore is that he was very hard on his mother. Am I correct? And kind of mocked her Catholicism, her piety.
You know what? Most of that was fabricated after 1860 to disparage the dynasty.
Wow.
Yes. For example, they came up with a thing that she was about to sit at the table one evening, and he pulled the chair away just as she was about to sit down, and she ended up on the floor. There's just no fact involved in that. Okay. He was a young man. From any indication, he truly loved her. We don't have a lot of information that he had mistresses. Of course, they were only married a few years before she died, but she accompanied him around the kingdom when he would do like inspection tours. She was a very pretty lady, very elegant and very sweet. In fact, to give you an idea also of the personality, the true personality of Ferdinand II when he wasn't playing real politic, a couple years before he died, somebody stabbed him. They were able to get close enough to him with a dagger and stab him. And he granted grace to the person. He did not have them executed. And at one point, a doctor, like a few months later, who was, you know, checking him out, said something like, well, that guy should be killed. And the king said, no, no, no. And I'm not giving you permission to say that. Okay. Wow. So I think there's been a serious effort to disparage the dynasty after 1860. And it goes on and on with examples that are completely divorced from reality. Okay.
It's interesting to talk about this idea, as Pat says, of the beatification being a local devotion and the canonization being a universal one, because, you know, the idea that there's a devotion locally in and around the Archdiocese of Naples, you know, you read this final letter from him to his people and you can understand the affection and affinity that he's leaving them with. I mean, he's ultimately sacrificing his dynasty and his life and his future for the safety of his people. And, you know, he's going to flee to Gaeta for his last stand. But when he leaves, you know, they leave with nothing. I mean, this is not like somebody who packed up the good china and whatever he could at the bank accounts. He leaves with nothing. So you're talking about a sense in this figure and his wife, these 23 and 19, I keep repeating, that this is a political uprising disturbance. But I don't think any of them see it as the end of the monarchy, even in the final days in Naples. So, you know, they're not taking the gold reserve. They're not taking any of the family's patrimony. I mean, you know, the heart of the collection of the National Archaeological Museum in Naples, which people still flock to today, is the Farnese marbles, the collection of amazing Greco-Roman artwork that was the personal patrimony of the Farnese family, from which the first king was descended on his mother's side. It became the personal collection of the Bourbons of the Two Sicilies, who you know, displayed it and allowed study of it in public exhibition in the Museo Borbonico, which became the National Archaeological Museum. That's their personal property. It's not part of the state. They leave it there, which it becomes part of the Italian state after the unification. They take nothing with them, and they flee to Gaeta, which, for those who are unfamiliar, is north of Naples, really one of the most well-fortified promontory fortresses on the entire Italian peninsula. It's almost impossible to get through. There's an isthmus leading from the mainland into the fortress. It's been a refuge of popes, as we said, in 1848, and kings for centuries. And so this is where they go to make their last stand with their loyal retainers and troops. And they're assuming they're going to be facing a Garibaldine invasion. What they don't really wager is that now the Piedmontese Savoyard Navy has decided to get involved as well, right?
Yes. Although there were some complications for a while, because at one point there were French ships that were there that did not permit the Piedmontese to fire cannon from the water. Okay. There were some complexities.
I want to talk briefly about Gaeta a little bit to give people a sense of what happened, because if we tell it as the history of just a siege, it loses, I think, some of the very rare personal insight that we get into the personality of the king and the queen, right?
Right.
The siege begins the November 5th, 1860, lasts all the way through February 13th, 1861.
Right.
Essentially, you have 20 some odd thousand Neapolitan and Sicilian troops with the king and queen and their advisors locked into this fortress, bombarded pretty much constantly.
Right.
I mean, the Piedmontese Navy is nonstop bombarding the fortress. A horrible rash of tuberculosis breaks out. The famous image is the king and queen actually taking up arms on the ramparts, fighting with the troops. The queen receives throughout Europe, even from people who were for the Italian unification, a begrudging reputation as a 19-year-old woman, incredibly courageous, nursing the troops back to health, fighting with them, it's really the lack of food, the tuberculosis. I mean, this is not an eventual surrender after all of those months for want of will or support for the dynasty. It's really just an impossible set of circumstances that sees the king and queen finally have to flee the fortress. And I go back to reading these accounts because I really love them. There's an account that was written by a French courtier.
Right.
And he describes on Valentine's Day, 1861, on the departure of Gaeta. And I just want to read it for the audience because I think I love first person history. And I think this is so important. It's on a French ship that they're finally going to leave after the surrender is agreed to. So it's Gaeta, 14 February, 1861, 8 a.m. The Neapolitan troops were drawn up in a line from the king's doorway to the sea gate, less than 300 paces. Their majesties left to board the Moët. The king, as a simple officer with a sword and spurs, the queen in a little hat with a green feather. A band played the national anthem. It was a scene of august simplicity, solemnity, and sadness. Ragged and exhausted soldiers presented arms to their sovereign for the last time, tears rolling down their cheeks. The expression of general woe was more striking as they advanced towards the sea gate. They hastened to kiss the king's hand. There was sobbing in the streets. The king, now very emaciated, was ghastly pale. One could read his emotions on his features. I could not see the queen's face. I looked away. As soon as they passed the sea gate, the crowd gave a loud cry of long live the king, and the garrison saluted this man, portrayed so unjustly as a dreadful tyrant. On the French frigate Moët, the royal flag flew from the mainmast. The king and queen gazed coldly at the Sardinian fleet while the Moët stood in the roads for more than an hour. When all the passengers were on board, the royal flag was lowered, and only the French flag remained to protect the vanquished sovereigns. The port battery saluted the king with the 21-gun salute. The large flag on the ramparts was slowly raked back and forth three times and then lowered for the last time. For a long time, the king had lingered alone in the stern, leaning on the gunwale and contemplating the cliffs of Gaeta. The exiles retire provisionally to Rome. Only the vicar of Jesus Christ seems to me worthy of offering them a shelter. Now, this is an impassioned French officer on board this boat. He has no interest in propaganda for this young king and queen. But I think it's safe to say, as we sort of set out to the final phases of describing this man's life, the reputation that they left with was one that really spit in the face of all of the negative propaganda that had been heaped upon them by the interested parties trying to sort of oust them from their dynastic seat. For those in the know who took the time to really understand the situation, I think their bravery, humility, and good faith was there to be seen. You know, I think that their reputation as they go off to Rome is one that their enemies wish they didn't have. Is that safe to say?
Yes, absolutely. And a big part of this beatification is that, okay, most Italians will be essentially indifferent to this type of thing, even most Catholics. As Pat said, there are a lot of people who are beatified nowadays worthily. I mean, but a big part of beatification isn't just the spiritual aspect of it. It's really to send a message that these are people who live in what most of us would like to think is a Christian manner.
Heroic Christianity.
Yes.
The Holy See defines canonization, beatification, is that they've kind of went above and beyond. It's like the Congressional Medal of Honor of Christianity.
Yes, exactly. And that they, if Francis II had ordered troops to shoot anybody, he probably would not be being beatified. In fact, he was known during the siege that when Piedmontese troops were typically cavalry, when they made it fairly close or they were taken prisoners, he would send them back. He would not even put them in the brig, you know, and say, okay, they're prisoners of war. He didn't even do that. He would take their weapons and just, you know, send them back. That's what they did, which was unheard of in those days. Nobody did that. They would, you know, normally there was no Geneva Convention in those days. God knows what they would have done.
Yeah.
Certainly in the years following the fall of the Two Sicilies, when the so-called brigands, partisans, let's say, the guerrilla warfare, when they were captured, or even some military officers who had simply served their king, were thrown in what might be called a concentration camp in the Alps in Piedmont called Fenestrelle. And at one point they had 300 people in there. Many of them were military officers who had never committed a crime. So this is what actually happened. And this is very much a, like I say, it's gotten more press the last 15, 20 years, but many Italians don't virtually nothing about it.
And, you know, could I add something a moment too? To the 87% of Italian Americans who have their ancestry from the South, the fall of Gaeta is why you're here.
Right.
Every single person who listens to this podcast, if you want to know why your family wound up in America or Australia or Canada and you're from the south of Italy, it's because Francis II was too nice a guy to be ruthless in war.
Yeah.
That's exactly why you're here today.
That's precise, because the economy basically deteriorated in the south, and the new industries that came about the next 30, 40 years were all in the north, the automobile industry and a lot of these other things. Money was taken from the south and it was allowed to languish. And what you had was the level of poverty. Actually, even the illiteracy increased, because when the schools that were run by the religious orders were closed, and that had been the greater part of the schools in the South, it took decades for the government in Rome to replace them with public schools. So there was about 20 or 30 years from about 1867, 1870, up until about 1890, where illiteracy in the South actually increased, because there were fewer people sending their kids to schools because the schools didn't exist. These are simple facts, that the great wave of emigration in the South really started about 1870, 1880. Before that, most of the people who left Italy were from north of Rome, not south of it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those years, right? Because Francis and Maria Sofia do escape aboard the French ship, the Moët. They go to Rome. They have a family home there, the Farnese Palace, which had been in their family from long before they were kings of the two sisters.
Right, and they had a daughter while they were there, who unfortunately died in infancy, named Maria Cristina.
See, hold on a minute. I tell you, name your kids after your parents. Even the king did the right thing and named his daughter after his mother.
That's right.
That's why he was a Neapolitan king.
That's right.
You name your kids names their profession. Baker, butcher, plumber, name your kid after a relative. That's it. I'm done.
the king did it right by tradition. But not only did she have the name Maria Cristina after her grandmother, but her middle name was Pia after Pope Pius, who was her godfather.
Yes, right, right.
If the Pope is your godfather, what do you think you get as a gift?
I'm sure it's a great gift.
It's probably a great gift. I mean, you can't outdo a Pope, you know, when the Pope's your godfather. That's it.
You know, it's interesting when I was reading, so this princess, the heiress to the Kingdom of Two Sicilies, for 3 months she lives, and she dies very sadly as a young infant. And really from this point on, in the 1870s, they last 10 years in Rome before Rome falls to the Kingdom of Italy and the Savoys. They leave right before the invasion in 1869, and many people think that the Pope's going to follow them. And of course, he decides, as we know, to hole up in the Vatican and become a prisoner of the Vatican until 1922. But in those 10 years that they're there, there's still a lot of belief and hope that they will be restored, that this experiment of a united Italy will not last. I mean, you have the outbreak of essentially a civil war in the South. You have all of the sort of foreign politics still playing on this, and the idea of the Pope's temporal powers and whatnot. So they live for many years in Rome with the expectation and financing essentially a court around them. They maintain embassies with countries like Russia and Austria and Spain. And over the years, slowly, all of those countries start to acknowledge a unified Italy. But when they leave in 1870, they've suffered the death of this young daughter that took them many, many years to conceive. Apparently, the king suffered from a congenitive disorder that essentially was akin to a botched circumcision, really, and made intercourse very painful. So even to conjugate the marriage was an issue for them. So they had this very difficult life together. And the idea of an heir, the announcement of this birth, the expectation was that a boy would follow soon and everything would go back to normal. And in Maria Cristina's death, you see this real sort of sense of hopelessness, I think, finally hit the king and the queen. And then shortly thereafter, Rome falls and they're forced to flee throughout Europe and eventually into Austrian territory within Italy, which will not become part of Italy till after World War I, in the town of Arco, in what's now Trento. And this is where the king lives out his life. But for all intents and purposes, he really has retired from any real public engagement after fleeing Rome. Is that fair to say? I mean, he's still sort of interacting, but the movement is shrinking.
He was still very much a symbol, and they basically went back and forth between Paris and Vienna for the most part, occasionally going to Munich, where her family was still essentially a sovereign family. And that's what they did for the next 25 years or so. When he was in Arco, Maria Sophia actually was not there, okay, because she often would go and stay with her sister, for example, in Vienna. And essentially, Francis II was a point of reference for a lot of people, but he was swept away in a certain sense because obviously back in Italy, you have a new government, you have a kingdom with all of its defects. It was still a sovereign state. It was technically at war with the Vatican until 1929, okay? But eventually, from about 1865, 1866, you had Austria, for example, finally established full diplomatic relations with the Kingdom of Italy. So you had all of these little political things going on. But Francis himself, he really didn't become too involved in what we would call, you know, international politics. Basically, he was an uncle, obviously, to a number of children. His brother had a very large family. And, you know, essentially, Francis was a family man. Unfortunately, his health deteriorated. It seems that he suffered from undiagnosed diabetes, which may also have been a problem that his father had. The difference being that Francis wasn't quite so heavy. He was never fat. But if you look at the photographs of him as he got older, he looked pretty rough. He didn't look like he was very healthy.
You know, it's interesting too. The description of him leaving Gaeta is decimated. You know, this is somebody who was raised in a royal court and just spent months and months and months fighting a siege hand in hand with his lowest ranking soldiers. They say when he got to Rome, you know, they really had nothing. They had to sell off what they could. They did leave everything in Naples thinking perhaps that they would go back or that it was more the patrimony of the people than them. So over these years, he's living the life of a king in exile with a very high quality of life, but they are sort of slowly selling off family properties and things like that.
Yes.
One of the stories that I found really interesting to attach to the United States was apparently he was very dedicated to those who came with him. A sort of mini Neapolitan court sprung up in Rome and eventually trickled some of them up into Austria. And even though the few valuables that he did have could have been sold for profit, some of them he just gifted to the loyal retainers that stood with him. One of them was an altar centerpiece by Raphael that he gifted to one of his retainers. And this courtier predeceased the king and actually willed it back to him. And because it was a religious artifact, the king refused to sell it to make money to finance his lifestyle. And so when he died, it eventually ended up being passed around. And then it was sold at auction and ended up being bought by J.P. Morgan and is currently on display in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which I never knew until doing research for this episode. It's amazing to me that you can go to the Met in New York City and see the altarpiece that was the king's and he was too devoted to ever sell, painted by Raphael. I mean, this is, again, the description that Lampedusa writes through the voice of the Princess Selina, that this is a seminarian dressed as a soldier. It seems to hold true in all of this. And I think this idea of beatification is a sort of stamp of recognition on a history that for many years has gone undiscussed.
Well, yes. And even to the point that Pope Pius compared him to Job, that's what he would say. This was like Job, somebody who was not only a very pious man, a very devout man, a very good man, but somebody who was actually a symbol of the people over whom he reigned. I mean, that there's no getting around that. That's, you know, simply what it is. We should probably also mention his wife lived until 1925.
Yeah.
She died in Munich. And it's kind of one of my little personal notes. I knew a princess of the two Sicilies who knew Queen Maria Sophia, which is kind of a cool thing because it's almost like a living link.
Yeah.
It was Princess Urraca, and she and her sister Lucia, who actually married Eugenio of Savoy, okay, in 1938. She had like a union between the two families, so to speak. So it was interesting that I met her and I interviewed her and we were in touch from time to time. We would send letters and things like that. To me, that was fascinating, okay, that to actually know somebody who knew the last queen of the two Sicilies.
What did she say?
Well, we talked about things. In fact, I occasionally asked her about things like the Queen's character. Okay, what she was like, and there were things that stuck out in my mind even about her. She was a very devout person, and she loved to ride her horses. That's what she did. At one point, I remember asking Baraka, who of course was only, you know, 12, 13 years old at the time. So it's also stuff that Baraka is getting from her mother, who knew the queen better. I said, well, what was she like politically? I mean, when she spoke about political issues, because she would read newspapers in several languages, okay? And I said, was she reactionary? Was she conservative in that sense? And Baraka said, no, she wouldn't use that word. That she had friends, women who were, you know, in those days, you know, going into like the 1920s, you had the Russian Revolution, you had women fighting for suffrage in places like the United States. There were all of these things going on. And yet she was actually quite open-minded, not by any means what you would call a liberal in today's vernacular, but she would respect and keep her friendship with these other ladies, even though she might have disagreed with their opinion on something. Her perception was that Maria Sofia was genuinely a very good, decent person, that she wasn't this nasty witch, which unfortunately was an image painted in Italy, because going into the early 1900s, there were people in Italy who had conspiracy theories that she was supporting anarchists, which is ludicrous, because it was the anarchists who killed her sister.
And there was also the rumors, wasn't there, that she supported the Austrians in the First World War, the Germans.
All of this kind of thing, which frankly, considering what was happening, why does any of that matter? But in reality, most likely, as far as we know, she wasn't actively doing this kind of thing. In fact, in Germany, during the First World War, she would go to prison camps and visit the Italian prisoners of war and, you know, bring them candy or cigarettes or whatever. So, you know, she was genuinely a good person. There's really not much to suggest otherwise.
But didn't she have an affair? Didn't their marriage get rocky at one point? And there also was a child she had out of wedlock that was put up for it. I'm not trying to bait it here, but isn't that part
the
story?
Yes, but and there's a biography. There's a biography about her that talks about this. Unfortunately, the biographies of her and her husband, unfortunately, these haven't been translated into English. Although there was somebody from the Netherlands a couple years ago wrote a little biography of Maria Sofia, which is actually quite good, which you can get on Amazon. The point is, depending on which version of the story you believe, she went to Germany, she got pregnant, she had either one child or she had twins. And see, here we go. We don't even know for a fact. Who, depending on one account, says that the child or the children were given up for effectively adoption, but it was a private adoption with no documentation, and they didn't live very long. So we really don't know that much about it, okay, which is why I'm a little bit maybe noncommittal. It's not out of just blind loyalty. It's really because we don't really know.
But aren't the rumors is that because of his medical condition that Francis II wasn't able to perform the marital act, to consummate the marriage on a regular basis, and between that and his piety, that kind of... The reason I'm going there with this is that for the general listenership, a lot of the part of the beatification of Francis II, is at least what I've heard, is that because she cheated in the marriage, he found out she had somebody else's child, where he really could have destroyed her life at that time and basically thrown her to the side, as they would. He forgave her and brought her back. I mean, is that correct? Is that's kind of basically...
It makes sense, but again, we just don't know all the facts. And the other thing is, after she supposedly had this child or children, she came back and they had their own child. There's just a lot about this that simply isn't known, okay? A lot of it amounts to gossip because we just don't have the information. And I'm not saying that I'm not by any means ruling it out. I'm just saying we just don't know enough about it to have a conclusion.
When everything fell apart, he did his best to be a royal person. And I think that in a lot of ways, Francis II lost his throne because he was super Catholic.
Yeah.
I mean, had he said to Garibaldi, yeah, you know, I'm in, let's take out the Pope and I'll be the king of a united Italy, I mean, the history books would be very different today.
I want to wrap up because we got 4 hours on here and I want to...
Though the rest of you out there in podcast land will only hear an hour.
That's true. Yeah,
we have been talking nonstop about every subjects are manageable because Lou is addictive.
Yeah, that's true. Lou is addictive. I mean, Pat, you make a great point. Like, this is a life of heroic Christianity, even in inactivity, even in its passivity, even in the decisions not to fight, take lives, to do damage to people and to patrimony. And I think it's an amazing legacy to be a part of and a figure that deserves a lot more attention. And keeping in mind now, looking back over the years of our own lives, this is a 23-year-old man who's making these decisions. And I just think that that's so amazing of a piece of history that we can tap into and our audience can learn more. And I highly recommend to everybody, I know how much people have enjoyed the episodes we've done so far with Lou. If you haven't already read the book, definitely go out and get it. Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, 1734 to 1861. You're going to get a lot more of this history in there, a much deeper dive into this figure of the king, his short but impactful reign, and really his life afterwards. So, you know, Lou, it's always a pleasure. I know Pat and I go crazy when we get to have you on. I mean, we've been talking for 4 hours here. So,
well, yeah, you know, it's yeah, because obviously, you know, you edit this and there's you know, whatever, but you know, you get the good parts. But when you consider this dynasty and even some of the medieval dynasties, I think something that perhaps a lot of, let's say, Italians in the diaspora maybe don't immediately think of is these are basically our royal families. Okay, this is us. This is part of our culture.
Yeah, I you know, that's how I know for me, my interest in Two Sicilies history grew when I had studied so much Italian history that I came to realize that my history was really the history of the South. And that was a big wow moment for me. And my dedication to this royal family that continues today in our service, all three of us as Knights of the Constantinian Order, and Pat and I in the delegation here in the U.S., it dawned on me at some point that this is our history and our royal family. And even if it's 150 some odd years later, 160 years later now, there's still a connectivity to that. There's still something real about that. And I was in Italy with Pat and Princess Beatrice working on a project that we continue to work on now to support local businesses in the South owned by young people. It's a passion project to Princess Beatrice, who is the sister of the current head of the house, Prince Carlo. And we were, Pat, I don't remember if we were in Campania or we were in Basilicata, but we were taken to a mill, a wheat mill.
Yeah, we were in the Cilento.
We were in Cilento. And it was these young guys who had basically revived these ancient ways of milling wheat and were working on reviving ancient varietals of local wheat that are actually harmless to those with gluten intolerance. So this is ancient Southern Italian wheat that doesn't impact negatively those with gluten intolerance. So obviously a big deal for a lot of the world. And they were showing us around and we all took a liking to each other. They were very dedicated to the royal family and the history. And when I got back from our trip, one of them sent me an email and said, I took it upon myself to do some genealogy for you. And he actually was able to find a cousin of my great-great-grandfather. And he sent me all these records on this cousin of mine named Vincenzo Viola, like my dad and my great-grandfather, who was a Bourbon soldier, apparently a very pious and dedicated man to the church, and who, after the unification, was invited to continue his career, his military career, with the Savoy Army, and refused and went into the woods to fight for the Bourbons. So I was so moved to have this documentation and to see, you know, you can really tie it to your own family life to know that somebody that shares your genetics was so devoted to this dynasty that they decided to give up their life and career and go into the woods and fight for what they saw as legitimate monarchy of their kingdom and their people. I just think, you know, like you say, this is ours.
And I'm sure, John, if that you looked into probably my ancestor at that time, they were having lunch. While your ancestor was there fighting for the king in the woods, the brigandaggio, as it was called, probably incorrectly, I can assure you that my ancestors were passing a bowl of macaroni somewhere. What was it? Francia Spagna. Basta Casimania.
Yeah, to me, the idea that you can have these connections going back, and like we said, like Pat said earlier, they define our Italian-Americanness. Without these events, we probably wouldn't be here, or we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't have come here when we did, or came to the places that we did in our diaspora of tens of millions of people, wouldn't exist.
But can I just say something else about Francis II? The two Sicilies, more than the most most of the continental powers, was kind of spared a lot of warfare and invasion. I think that created the Southern Italian like a penguin. Because we're not, I mean that seriously, yeah, because right. we were not a warring people.
Yeah.
So when Garibaldi came down, we didn't have that viciousness, that combative. I mean, like, look at we had a really nice king. I mean, he lost the war, he lost the kingdom, and there he's settling in POWs back. You know, it's like when the fascist powers in World War II created the concentration camp in Campania where the Jews were sent. And look, correct me, because you're the historian. And the people in Campania were like, Campania the city in Campania the region. Well, they let the Jewish people were allowed out during the day. And they're like, you know, come home at night and just make believe in case the Germans show up. Like we lack that. I mean, we're vicious to our own relatives. You know, we'll be the people we're close to, we can have a nasty too, but you know, to people closest to us, but we're not a combative people. And I think that Francis II was very emblematic of the Southern Italian saying, listen, I love being king, but I don't want to see Naples destroyed.
Yeah.
Like make Naples an open city. I think it's such a view into the Southern Italian brain, because we're not a violent, unless you're going to purposely hurt our family. But people who are close to us, we're not a vicious people.
It's a question of how you define your nation and what the ethos is of that nation. And obviously, in some countries, that kind of thing is more important than, you know, traditionally than it is in others. It's just a question of the way things develop.
I love the idea that the family reflected always the sort of spirit and, like you say, Lou, the ethos of the population. And I know somebody once said to Francis II after he had been deposed, you know, something to the effect of like, did you understand it was all about Italian nationalism? And he said, I don't understand. I don't know Italian nationalism. I only know Neapolitan nationalism. And this idea that there was a distinct identity to the people in the kingdom. And while it might not have exercised itself in a martial nation statehood, it exercised itself in identity and traditions and customs. And, you know, those are the things that we took with us here. And many of the things that we do, you know, after the Savoys invaded and repressed the churches and closed the Catholic schools and things like that, one of the main things that they decided to do was actually repress the local holidays and support these holidays themed around the unification and events in the unification. So in some places, there's an interruption to local saint day. So every time we go out and we celebrate our local saints in our communities, we're accessing that very unique, very independent culture that existed for 1,000 years in this kingdom that came to a close. And I think people don't realize that, you know?
That's correct. And I think if you look at the actual personal culture in the royal family, you know, for example, supposedly the favorite food of Francis II was lasagna.
Yeah.
And one of his nicknames was Laza. And it's interesting also that starting with Ferdinand I, and then Francis I, Ferdinand II, all of these kings at court spoke Neapolitan as their first language.
Yeah.
Thank you. Take note of that, folks.
Yes. Yes.
All those people who say dialect, take note of
right.
that.
Right. And the court was very much Neapolitan. It was unambiguously part of the local culture, which I think is something that kind of, it's an idea that kind of gets washed away. It's not something imaginary. It's very real.
Yeah. This is a big part of kind of what draws me, and I know Pat and all of us, to this history and on this show to tell it. So I'm really glad that we could spend some time with you, Lou, today. And you're always such a great resource and storyteller and guide to all this. So thank you for coming back. And I know we're going to have 25 different topics
buy
we can
the
take
book.
On. Yeah.
Buy the book. Yeah. You want to learn about Italian culture, buy the book. Because people like Lou can't do what they're doing unless they got Lubogas order in their pocket. So help out Lou. His books are fantastic. If you don't like Lou's book, I will publicly eat it on the internet. If anyone can say that they don't enjoy Lou's book, I will publicly eat it because they are fantastic books. Buy them for yourself. Buy them for your relatives, because with all of the Italian-American populace, Deanna, all the other people, part of the podcast family, who are our own Stephanie Longo, who are writing and publishing, They need your support. They're not doing this for charity because they have to eat too. So if you want to support the community, go out and buy a book. Give your kid a book. Buy your child a book. Don't buy a loose book. And you want to know something? Buy one book for you and buy one book for your local library. Go down to the local library, ask the librarian, the head librarian, if they will accept the donation and donate the book. That's how you bring about change. I'm done.
Amen. That's so important.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's guys like you, Lou, that that help spread the word and teach guys like us. So hopefully we're doing the same on this platform. So always a pleasure to have you on. I hope everybody enjoyed this week's episode and continues their own further research into this figure and this history and this king.
Yes.
So we'll have you back, Lou.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Ba, 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 da.
I can live without the rye. I can live without that.
How about this time we close with the royal anthem, Pat? How about we play that out?
Ba, 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 ba,
perfect.
Ba.
Thanks for listening.
Do we have a kazoo? Charity and Pop and kazoo.
Yeah,
I can't play instruments.
I think there's going to be a lot of editing with that.